fast they'd be cut off. And we're going to. He lifted his whistle and blew loudly. The advance below broke into a run, even as he did. Harvey waved his command into their truck and the travel-all. Jacob Vinge took Bill's place. Harvey sent the truck out, then hesitated. We ought to try. Come on, a few rounds.
It won't do any good, Marie Vance said. There's too much cover, and they aren't showing themselves enough. We'd be trapped, and we wouldn't have hurt any of them.
How do you know so much about strategy? Harvey demanded.
I watch war movies. Let's get out of here.
All right. Harvey turned the travel-all and drove away, down off the ridge and into the next valley. The truck stopped and let the running men get aboard.
Poor bastards, Marie said.
We fought them for a day, Vinge said, but we couldn't hold them, like the ridge back there. They spread out and get around you, behind you, and then you're dead. So you have to keep running. After a while it can get to be a habit.
Sure. Habit or not, Harvey thought. They had run like rabbits, not like men. The road led down to a stream swollen with the rain of Hammerfall. The low parts of the valley were deep mud. Harvey stopped at the far side of the small bridge and got out to light dynamite sticks already in place.
There they are!
One of the boys shouted. Harvey looked up on the ridge. 100 and more armed enemies boiled over the top and came down the hill at a dead run. There was a staccato chatter and a rustle in the grass not far from Harvey.
Get it done!
Jacob Vinge shouted.
They're shooting at us!
It was nearly a mile up to the ridge, but that sound was familiar from Vietnam, a heavy machine gun. It wouldn't take long to walk its fire over to Harvey and the travel-all, and then they'd be finished. He flicked his Zippo and blessed it when it caught the first time, even though it was filled with gasoline rather than regular lighter fluid. The fuse sputtered, and Harvey ran for the travel-all. Marie had slid over into the driver's seat and was already rolling. Harvey caught on, and hands grabbed him and pulled him inside. There was more of the chatter, brup, 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 and something roared past his ear.
"Holy shit!"
he yelled.
"They shoot pretty good," Vinge said.
The dynamite went off, and the bridge was in ruins. But not completely, Harvey saw. There was still a full span, wide enough to walk across. It wasn't going to take long to repair, but he sure wasn't going back. They drove up to the top of the next ridge and got out, looking for more trees to drop, boulders to dynamite into the road, anything. The new Brotherhood troops came on into the valley, some on foot, a dozen on motorcycles. They reached the ruined bridge and stopped, then a few swam and waded across and came on. Others spread along the banks and found new crossings. In 5 minutes, 100 had crossed, and they walked on steadily toward Harvey's work crews.
Jesus, it's like watching the tide come in, Harvey said.
Jacob Vinge didn't say anything. He kept on digging under a boulder to make a hole for the dynamite. Just above them, a tree crashed across the road, and the boys moved to another. There were motors in the valley ahead. Two motorcycles gingerly drove across the narrow remains of the bridge. Extra riders got on, and the bikes gunned forward toward Harvey's position. Marie Vance unslung her rifle and worked the sling around her left arm.
"Go on digging," she called.
She took a sitting position and rested the rifle on a large rock, then squinted through the telescopic sights. She waited until the bikes were about a quarter of a mile away before she fired. Nothing happened. She worked the bolt and aimed again. Fired. At the third shot, the lead motorcycle wobbled and swerved into the ditch at the side of the road. One of the riders got up. Marie aimed again, but the other bike moved off the road and the riders scrambled for cover. They waited for the advancing skirmish line. That came steadily closer, and Marie changed her aim point, firing to slow the advance. Again, the center of the line slowed, while more attackers spread to each side, fanning out well beyond any point Harvey could defend.
"Get finished!" Harvey shouted. "We have to get out of here!"
No one argued with that. Vinge put two sticks of dynamite into the hole beneath the boulder and tamped mud in on top of it.
"Look!"
Barbara Ann, Tommy Tallison's partner, shouted in horror. She pointed at the opposite ridge, where they'd spent the dawn hours putting barriers on the road. A truck appeared at the top of the ridge.
It went over and came down the road, and another followed, then another. When the trucks reached the downed bridge, men jumped out with timbers and steel plates. More trucks came over the ridge. Harvey looked at his watch. They had delayed the enemy trucks by precisely 38 minutes. Valley of Death. "Lordy, lordy, won't you listen to me? The colonel said stand, but it ain't gonna be. 'Cause we're bugging out. Yes, we're moving on." The Bug Out Boogie, a forbidden ballad of the United States Army. The pattern was always the same. No matter what obstructions Harvey's group put into the road, the new Brotherhood Army was delayed for no longer than it took to put them up. If Task Force Randall could have actively defended its roadblocks, they might have stopped the advancing enemy for much longer, but there was no chance of that. The new Brotherhood used its trucks to bring troops as far forward as possible. Their skirmishers then spread out to both flanks and advanced, threatening to cut Harvey off, and once again Harvey had to retreat. The enemy developed a new tactic as well. They mounted heavy machine guns in one of their trucks and brought that forward to fire on Harvey's workers from well out of rifle range. It kept Harvey from doing a proper job of ruining the road, and he couldn't even shoot back. The enemy were faceless ghosts who couldn't be harmed, and Harvey couldn't stop them. Their infantry continued to advance, avoiding Harvey's defenders, trying always to get around and behind. It was battle at long range, with few casualties, but the new Brotherhood's advance was relentless. By mid-afternoon, they had come 12 miles toward the stronghold. Work and run, and running was becoming a habit. 12 times Harvey wanted to keep going, to drive for the stronghold and the devil with the roadblocks. His mind found 12 excuses for running. "It's like nothing can stop them," Tommy Tallison screamed. They had halted at another ridgeline. The maps said the valley below, where the new Brotherhood was busily removing trees, filling in holes, repairing the road quicker than Harvey had been able to destroy it, was called Hungry Hollow. The name seemed appropriate. "We've got to try," said Harvey. Tallison looked doubtful. Harvey knew what he was thinking. They were all exhausted. They'd lost 5 of Task Force Randall. One shot dead as he worked with a chainsaw, the other 4 vanished. Run away, captured, wounded and lying back in the hills. They didn't know. They hadn't got aboard when it was time to bug out, and the new Brotherhood had been too close to let them look for them, and running had become a habit. What could 8 exhausted people do to stop a horde that flowed forward like the tide? "It will be dark in a couple of hours," Harvey said. "Then we can rest." "Can we?" Tallison asked, but he went back to work, digging out under another boulder above the road. Others stretched the cable from the travel-all's winch around the rock. There wasn't enough dynamite to use on every rock they found. An hour before dark, they were forced out of Hungry Hollow and over the ridge beyond. They fled across Deer Creek, pausing only long enough to light the fuse on the dynamite they'd placed there. When they climbed onto the next ridge, they found men already there. It took Harvey a moment to realize they were friends. Steve Cox and almost 100 troops had been sent from the ranch to hold the ridge. The stronghold forces were through running away. Now they would stand and fight. Cox had spread his forces along the ridge, and they dug in. Harvey and Task Force Randall, what was left of it, could rest. There was even cold supper and a thermos of hot tea. "We're all dead on our feet," Harvey told Steve Cox. "We won't be much help." Cox shrugged. "That's all right. Get a good night's sleep. We'll hold them." "You're a fool," Harvey wanted to say. "There are 1,000 of them and 100 of you. And they come like death, like army ants, and nothing can stop them." "Have you brought... How is Forrester's work? Have you got any of his super weapons?"
"Thermite grenades." Cox showed Harvey a box of what looked like lumps of baked clay with fuses stuck out of the top. Each was about 6 inches in diameter, and each had 2 feet of parachute cord attached to it.
"You light the fuse and whirl it around," Cox said, "then throw it."
"Do they work?"
"They sure do."
Cox was enthusiastic.
Some explode like bombs. Others just break open. But even then, they throw fire 10 or 12 feet. They'll scare the hell out of those cannibal bastards.
But what about the other weapons? Mustard gas?
Cox shrugged.
They're working on it. Hardy says it will take time. That's why we're out here.
In the valley below, the lead elements of the new Brotherhood force had reached the ruined bridge. Deer Creek was high and swift, and the bridge was entirely gone. The few men who tried to wait it gave up quickly. The Brotherhood army stopped, then began to spread along the banks. Elements went upstream until they vanished. Others turned downstream toward the sea a few miles to the west.
"They'll get around us," Harvey said nervously.
"Nope,"
Cox grinned. He pointed upstream toward the towering Sierra.
"We've got allies up there. About 50 Tool Indians, some of Christopher's reinforcements. Tough bastards.
Get some sleep, Randall. They won't get through here. Not tonight, and not tomorrow. We've got a good position. We'll hold them."
"I think Cox is crazy," Harvey told Marie.
We've seen the new Brotherhood fight. He hasn't."
"They have our radio reports," Marie said. She stretched in the back seat of the travel-all.
"Feels good to relax. I could sleep for a week."
"So could I," Harvey said. But he didn't.
The travel-all was parked on the far side of the ridge from Deer Creek. He had sent the others back further, to a farmhouse where they could get proper rest, and he knew he should join them, but he was worried. Harvey had learned to respect whoever was in charge of the new Brotherhood. The enemy general hadn't wasted a man, had never exposed his people recklessly, yet he had swept through 18 miles and more in less than a day. And he was using gasoline and ammunition recklessly. This was an all-out war. The new Brotherhood must have stripped their territory, must be gambling on taking the stronghold for new supplies. Dusk brought a chill wind, but no more sleet. A few stars showed through the overcast, blinking points of light too far apart to recognize as constellations. Harvey remembered a hot sauna followed by a cold swimming pool in hot sunlight. He remembered driving the travel-all south through the blazing desert beauty of Baja California, finally to swim in an ocean warm as a bathtub, belly surfing the bigger, more exciting waves of Hermosa Beach, and spreading a towel over sand too hot to walk on. Down in the valley they could hear the sounds of Brotherhood trucks and men moving heavy objects. There was no way to know what the enemy was doing. Cox had patrols alert for infiltrators, but instead the enemy commander had his men fire weapons at irregular intervals, raise shouts, throw grenades and rocks across the creek, and often the ranchers responded, shooting wildly into the night, wasting ammunition, losing sleep. Harvey knew that was what the Brotherhood wanted, but the knowledge didn't help. He slept fitfully, awakened too often. Marie stirred in the seat behind him.
"You awake?"
she whispered.
"Yes."
"Who was it in the truck with the binoculars? Do you know?"
"Probably the sergeant, Hooker. Why?"
"Put a name on him and he's less frightening. Do you think we can win? Is Hardy smart enough?"
"Sure," Harvey said.
"They keep coming, like a machine, a huge grinding machine."
Harvey sat up. Somewhere a grenade went off, and Cox shouted not to waste ammunition.
"That's a frightening image." "Fortunately, it's not the right one," Harvey said. "It's not a meat grinder. It's one of those kinetic structures where the artist invites a horde of newsmen to stand around and drink and watch while the machine tears itself to pieces."
Her laugh sounded forced. "Nice imagery, Harv."
"Hell, I made a living off imagery before I took up breaking rocks and ruining roads. I used to think of battles as a chess game, but they're not. It's like those sculptures. The commander puts together this huge sculpture, knowing that the pieces will grind each other up, and he doesn't control them all. Half of them are controlled by an art critic who hates him, and each one tries to see that he has pieces left when it's over. But there won't be enough, so it has to be done over and over."
"And we're some of the pieces," Marie said.
I hope Hardy knows what he's doing.
In the morning, there was new excitement in the Stronghold camp. During the night, Stephen Tallman, vice president of the Tool Council, had come in to tell how his warriors were dug in to the east, and more were coming. The rumors grew. George Christopher was coming back, and he had 100, 200, 1,000 armed ranchers he'd recruited from the hill country. Anyone who doubted it was shouted down. But certainly there were 50 Indians to the east, and all the ranchers talked about how tough the Indians were and what great allies they'd be. There were other stories of an attempt in the night by the new Brotherhood to force passage of Deer Creek 5 miles upstream, and how Tallman's Indians had beaten them back and killed dozens, how the new Brotherhood had run away. When Harvey talked to the others, he could find nobody who had seen the battle. He found a few who claimed to have spoken to someone who was in it. Everyone had a friend who'd talked to Tallman himself, or to Stretch Talifson, who was with the ranch force sent upstream to hold the western end of the line. It was always like this. The new guys were demons incarnate. They would go through the enemy like so many mincing machines. The new guys always thought so, too. But it could be true. Sometimes it was true. Maybe they would win this after all. The new Brotherhood could be stopped, and it wouldn't even take the full strength of the Stronghold to do it. Clouds parted in the east, the sun shone shockingly bright. Full daylight, and still nothing happened. The ranchers on the forward skirmish line of the Brotherhood exchanged sniping shots with little effect. Then, over the opposite ridge, trucks appeared. They didn't look like trucks. They looked strange, for they had large wooden structures attached in front of them. They came down the hill, not too fast, because with all that weight in front they were hard to drive and unstable, but they came on toward the swollen creek. At the same time, hundreds of the enemy came out from behind rocks and folds of ground where they'd been hidden. They began firing at anything that moved. The trucks with their strange towers advanced to the stream edge, and some drove across meadows that should have been too swampy, except that during the night the Brotherhood had laid down tracks of fencing wire and planks to get them across the mud. They went to the stream edge and the towers fell, making bridges across the stream. Brotherhood troops rushed toward the bridges, began swarming across. Other Brotherhood units concentrated fire on any Stronghold defenders who dared show themselves. Harvey heard the sharp whoomp, which he recognized from Vietnam. Mortars. The mortar bombs fell among the rocks where Cox's ranchers hid, and each time they fell more accurately. Someone across the river was directing them, and he had good control. Wherever Cox's men tried to oppose the crossing, the mortars soon found them. And more of the Brotherhood troops poured across the river. They fanned out and moved forward along a line almost a mile wide, and Cox's forward troops either fell back or were overrun. Suddenly, it had taken no more than half an hour. The river line was gone, and Cox held only the ridge, and even there the relentless mortars and machine guns, far out of range of effective rifle fire, sought them out, pinned them down, while more Brotherhood troops advanced up the hills, hiding behind boulders, dodging and leapfrogging, and always moving on. "Ants!" Harvey screamed. "Army ants!" Now he knew. The cannibals couldn't be stopped. They'd been fools to think they could do it. And at the rate they advanced, Cox would lose most of his force. Already groups of men had begun to break and run, some throwing down their weapons, others grimly hanging on to them and stopping to shoot back at the enemy. But there was no organization to the defense any longer, and more saw it and thought only of saving themselves. There was no place to make a stand. Every position was threatened by a breakthrough at some other point, and these men had not fought together, lived together. They didn't have confidence that the man down the line wouldn't run and leave an opening for the yelling cannibals to pour through and cut them off forever. A dozen men clung to the travelall, piled into it, hung on top, or lay on fenders as Harvey drove away. Deer Creek, which Cox had expected to hold all day, perhaps even to break the Brotherhood and stop them permanently, had fallen in less than an hour and a half.
The rest of the morning was nightmare. Harvey could not find his truck. The only equipment he had left was in the travel-all, and only a few of Cox's ranchers were willing to help. Reinforcements from the stronghold came finally. 20 men and women with more dynamite and gasoline and the chainsaws from the truck, but they could never get far enough away from the advancing Brotherhood forces to do any useful work. The Brotherhood tactics had changed. Now, instead of fanning out and outflanking the defenses, they flooded forward, trying to close. They wanted to keep the stronghold force running, and now their general was willing to spend men to do it. If Marie had not been with him, Harvey would have run with the rest, but she wouldn't let him. She insisted they keep on with their mission, at least that they stop and light the fuses of the charges they'd set 2 nights before when they went forward. Once they delayed too long, and there was a crash. Shattered glass from the rear window sprayed over them, and the front windshield was smashed out as well. A 50-caliber slug had passed all the way through the travel-all, passed between them, missing them by inches. The next time they stopped, the ranchers who'd stayed with them abandoned the car. Harvey yelled to Marie, "Why the hell are you so—" He didn't finish the sentence. He wanted to say brave, but if he did, it meant he wasn't, that he was a coward. "Determined," he finally said. She looked up from where she was digging. They had one last stick of dynamite, and she wanted to plant it. She pointed up toward the Sierra. "My boy is up there," she said. "If we don't stop them, who will?" "This is good enough. Give me the dynamite." Harvey had already crimped fuse onto the cap. He handed her the stick, and she thrust it into the hole, then shoveled dirt and rock onto it. "That's enough," Harvey screamed. "Let's get out of here." They were on the far side of a low hill and couldn't see the advancing enemy, but Harvey didn't think they would be far behind. "Not yet," Marie said. "Something I have to do first." She walked toward the hilltop. "Come back here. I swear I'll leave you. Hey!" She didn't look back. After a moment, he cursed, then followed her uphill. She was adjusting her rifle, setting the strap on her left arm. She braced herself against a rock. "Down there is where you put the oil, and the mines," she said. "We drove right past it."
"We had to. They were right behind us.
And it's all so damned futile anyway." Motorcycles were coming up the road. They'd reach the ridge in a minute or two. Marie took careful aim. Fired. "Good," she muttered to herself. She fired again.
"I'd be done quicker if you'd do some shooting, too," she said.
Harvey knew he wasn't about to hit the oil drum set 300 yards away. He braced his rifle on a rock and aimed at the first of the oncoming motorcycles. He fired again and again, and missed each time. But the cyclists slowed, then stopped and took cover in the ditch to wait for the infantry. Marie continued to fire, slowly, carefully. Finally, she said, "That ought to do it. Let's go. Actually, what's the hurry? They're stopped." She took up her position again and waited. Harvey clenched his fists and took a deep breath. She was right. There was no immediate danger. The oil was spilling across the road now, and the two motorcycles were going nowhere. Another motorcycle reached the oil slick. It skidded into the ditch, and the bikers screamed. Marie smiled faintly. "Good idea, those punji sticks of yours." Harvey looked at her in horror. Marie Vance, on the board of governors of half a dozen charities, banker's wife, socialite, country club member, and she was grinning at the thought of a man impaled on a stick smeared with human shit to make the wounds fester. A truck came to the oil slick and stopped. Then it started forward, slowly. Marie put a bullet through its windshield. It slid forward and skidded, turning slightly sideways. The motor gunned and the wheels spun, but it did not move. Another truck came up behind it and started around. One of the dynamite mines went off, loudly, and the truck went up in flames. Harvey felt it now, the urgent impulse to shout in triumph. Something had worked. Those weren't people down there, scrambling to get away from the burning truck, some themselves burning. They were army ants, and the trick had worked. They heard the plop from in front of them, then a faint whistle. Something exploded 20 yards to their left.
Another plop.
The car! Now, damn it!
Harvey shouted. Yes, I think it's time. Marie followed. The second mortar round went off somewhere behind them. They leaped into the travel-all and drove off, laughing and shouting like children.
Son of a bitch, it worked!
Harvey shouted. He looked over at Marie, and her eyes shone with triumph to match his own. We make a great team, he thought.
Run away! Cried Harvey.
Marie looked at him strangely.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail,
Harvey said.
Didn't you see it?
No. They drove on, still laughing with excitement. Inside, Harvey knew it wasn't really much of a victory, but it was better than the rest of the day. There was no question of stopping now, not until they reached the next large barrier, which was a fork of the Tule River. That would be a formidable barrier once its bridge was blown. Surely it would stop the new Brotherhood. It had to. Beyond was the ridgeline that marked the entrance to the stronghold itself. The Tule was their most important defense line. They came around a curve and started down into the Tule Valley. And there was no bridge. It had already been blown. Harvey drove up to the wrecked bridge and stared at the swollen river, 100 feet wide and deep and swiftly flowing.
Hey!
He shouted. Across the river, one of Hartman's constables rose from hiding behind a log bunker.
They said you'd had it, he called.
What do I do now?
Harvey shouted.
Whatever it is, do it quick, Marie said. They won't be far behind us.
Go upstream, the constable yelled. We've got troops up there. Make sure you radio ahead that you're coming.
All right. Harvey turned the travel-all and started up the county road toward the Tule Indian Reservation.
Get on that CB, he told Marie. Tell them the reports of our death have been greatly exaggerated.
A mile and a half upstream, the road crossed the Tule. 12 men were working with shovels at the bridge foundations. Harvey drove up warily, but they waved him on. He drove across and stopped. They looked like ranchers, but they were darker and did not show the effects of months without sunlight. Harvey wondered if lack of vitamin D would affect them. Pale faces were evolved for life in a cold, cloudy environment. One of the work crew left off digging and came over to the travel-all.
Randall.
Yes.
Look, the new Brotherhood must be right behind us. We know where they are, the man said. Alice can see them, and we've got a radio. You're supposed to go on up there onto Turtle Mountain and help her observe. Find a place where you can see the valley and still get her on the CB.
All right, thanks. And we're glad to have you on our side. The Indian grinned.
I see it that you're on our side. Good luck.
Their earlier mood of elation had vanished now. They drove on along an increasingly difficult road. Mud, fallen rocks, deep ruts. Harvey put the travel-all into four-wheel drive. As they climbed higher, the entire valley came into view. To the southwest was the South Fork of the Tule and the road junction and bridge they'd just left. The fork ran northwest to the remains of Lake Success, where it joined the Tule itself. A ridge separated the forks of the Tule, the ridge that guarded the stronghold. From their vantage point, Harvey and Marie could see the defense line of Police Chief Hartman's troops, trenches and foxholes and log bunkers. There were less elaborate defenses thrown forward into the South Fork Valley. They didn't look adequate to hold. Only the high ridge lines seemed well defended. A classic crust defense, Harvey thought. The enemy need only punch through, and there was nothing to stop them from overrunning the entire stronghold. At dusk, it was clear what the enemy's plan was. He brought up his trucks, dug in his troops, and lit large campfires in plain sight of the stronghold. They looked relaxed, confident, and Harvey knew they'd be working on bridges during the night. Finally, dark came, and the hills were silent.
"Well, we can't see anything more," Harvey said. "Now we really don't have anything to do."
Marie moved restlessly beside him. In the dark, she was only a presence, her very shape indeterminate. But Harvey grew itchingly aware that Marie Vance was only inches away, and that they were cut off from the universe until sunrise. His memory played him a dirty trick. It showed him Marie Vance some weeks before Hammerfall, as she met Harvey and Loretta at her front door.
She wore emeralds and a vividly green evening gown cut nearly to the navel. Her hair was set in fantastic convolutions. She smiled graciously and hugged him and welcomed them in. His mind superimposed that image on the dark blur next to him, and the silence grew really uncomfortable.
"I can think of something," she said softly.
Harvey found his voice. "If it isn't sex, you'd better tell me now." She said nothing. He slid toward her and pulled her against him. Things crunched and crackled. Not one of the dozen pockets in that jacket was empty. She chuckled and took it off while he doffed his own jacket with its own lumpy pockets. Then the terror of the day and the danger of tomorrow, the slow, agonizing death of a world, and the coming end of the stronghold could be forgotten in the frantic importance of each other. The passenger footwell grew cluttered with clothing until Harvey broke off and dumped the whole armful behind the steering wheel. The passenger seat wasn't shaped for this, but they coupled with care and ingenuity and maintained the position afterward, he half reclining in the passenger seat, she kneeling before him, her face above his. Their breath fell each on the other's cheek.
"I'm glad you thought of something," he said presently. He couldn't say he loved her.
"Ever screwed in a car before?"
He thought back.
"Sure. I was more limber then."
"I never did."
"Well, generally you use the back seat, but..."
"The back seat's covered with broken glass," Marie finished, and they felt each other's tension as they remembered. A 50-caliber bullet, glass showering everywhere, Marie brushing the tiny splinters off him while he drove. But there was a way to forget. And again, later, there was a way to forget, the same way repeated with the same frantic urgency. They were not drawn to each other, he thought. They were thrust against each other in their fear of what was outside them. They made love with their ears cocked for gunfire. But they made love. Even when it's bad, it's good. Harvey woke before dawn. He was covered with the blanket from the back seat, but he couldn't remember getting it. He lay awake, not moving, his thoughts confused.
"Hi," Marie said softly.
"Hi yourself. I thought you'd be asleep."
"Not for a while. You get some rest."
Harvey tried, but there were twinges from muscles he'd overused last night, and twinges from his conscience, which apparently hadn't been informed that he was a widower whose new girl had dropped him for an astronaut. To hell with that. But he still wasn't sleeping.
"Oh well," he said, and sat up. "We seem to have survived the night."
"I didn't work you that hard." There might have been something false in his own laugh, or... She'd known him a long time. She turned toward him in the dark.
"You're not worried about Gordy, are you? That's all over. He's got his new girl, and it doesn't need a judge to say a marriage is over. We didn't really need one before."
Harvey hadn't been thinking of Gordy.
"What will you do now?" he asked.
"When this is over, if..." She laughed.
"I won't stay a cook, but thank you for bringing me to this valley. It's been much better than anything I could have found for myself."
She was quiet for a moment, and they heard a sound outside, an owl and the squeal of the rabbit it had caught.
"It's a man's world now," Marie said, "so I guess I'll just have to marry an important one. I've always been a status-conscious bitch, and I don't see any reason to change now. In fact, there's more reason than ever. Muscle counts. I'll find me a leader and marry him."
"And who would that be?"
She giggled.
"After yesterday, you're a leader. You're an important man."
She slid across to him and put her arm around him. Then she laughed aloud.
"What's got you so tense? Am I that terrifying?"
"Certainly."
She was. She laughed again.
"Poor Harvey. I know exactly what you're thinking. Obligation. You've seduced the girl, and you ought to marry her, and you know damn well you can't resist if I really work at it. See?"
Her hands moved to intimate places. Living with Loretta hadn't readied him for this kind of warfare. He kissed her hard. She couldn't bluff Harvey Randall, and maintained the kiss because it felt so good,
and hell, Maureen had her winged man, until she drew back.
"That wasn't very nice of me," she said.
"Don't worry, Harv, I'm really not after you. It wouldn't work.
You know me too well. No matter what we did, even if we really did learn to love each other, you'd always wonder about it. You'd wonder if it was all an act, wonder when I'd decide to drop it. And we'd fight and play head games and dominance games."
I was thinking something like that.
"Don't talk yourself into anything," Marie said. "I don't need that. I would like to be your friend."
"Sure, I'd like that. Who's your real target?"
"Oh, I'm going to marry George Christopher."
Harvey was startled.
"What? Does he know?"
"Of course not. He still thinks he's got a chance with Maureen. He tells me about her every chance he gets, and I listen, too."
"I just bet you do.
What makes you think he won't get Maureen?"
"Don't be silly. With you and Johnny Baker to choose between? She'll never marry George. If they hadn't known each other forever, if he weren't her first, she wouldn't even consider him."
"And me?"
"You got a chance. Baker has a better one."
"Yeah, I suppose it would be silly to ask if you're in love with George," Harvey said. Marie shrugged. He could feel that in the dark.
"He'll be sure I am," she said. "And it won't be anybody else's business. There won't be any repetitions of tonight, Harvey. This was something special. The right man at the right time. I've always... Tell me, all those years we lived next door, weren't you ever tempted to come over some afternoon when Loretta was out and Gordy was at the bank?"
"Yes, but I didn't."
"Good. Nothing would have happened, but it always worried me that you didn't try." "Good. Now let's get some sleep."
She turned away and curled up in the blanket. "Poor George," Harvey thought.
"No, that's not right.
Lucky George. If I didn't know her so damned well. Damn it, I'm still tempted." "George, you don't know it, but you're about to be a happy man. If you live long enough. If Marie lives." Dawn. A red smear in the Sierra. The winds blew fitfully, light airs. Mist rose from the San Joaquin Sea. When the sun was high, they saw them. 100 or more of the new brotherhood had crossed during the night. They were concentrated near the old Lake Success bed, and they moved back toward the ruined bridge, sweeping aside the screen of stronghold defenders. The Brotherhood's mortars began to fire, forcing the defenders back up the valley and onto the ridges. The withdrawal was orderly but steady. "By noon they'll have cleared the valley," Harvey told Marie. I hoped they'd hold longer. At least they aren't running like rabbits." She nodded, but went on reporting the enemy positions on the CB. There wasn't anything else to do. Alice sounded terrified whenever she spoke, but she demanded their reports anyway. Useless, Harvey thought. It's no good. He looked at the map, wondering if he could find a way into the Sierra that didn't go back down and through the enemy, or where the new brotherhood would be soon.
"They're repairing the bridge," Marie reported. "They've got big trees and hundreds to carry them." "How long until they can get trucks across?" Alice asked. "No more than an hour." "Stand by. I have to report that to Mr. Hardy," Alice said.
The radio went silent. "It's no good," Harvey said. He tried to smile. "Looks like it's you and me after all. Maybe we can get up there and find the boys. I don't suppose I'll have to fight Gordy for you."
"Shut up and watch," Marie said. She sounded scared, and Harvey couldn't blame her.
The bridge took a little more than an hour. Then a stream of trucks, led by the pickups with the machine guns, moved over them. They swept on up the valley roads. Other trucks brought the new Brotherhood mortars forward, while crews dug in emplacements for them. The Brotherhood army swarmed into the valley below, probed toward the ridges, fell back wherever opposed. They had plenty of time, and night would be on their side now. They could infiltrate men through the rocks, over the ridges, into the stronghold itself. The day became warmer, but not for Harvey and Marie. The rising air from the San Joaquin Sea drew a cold wind down from the Sierra. The enemy moved on forward in the cloudy, bright day.
Noon came, and they had reached the far end, were beginning to climb the ridges toward the last defenses.
"Stand by,"
Alice said. She sounded excited now, not afraid.
"Stand by for what?" Harvey demanded.
"To watch and report," Alice said. "That's why you're there. I can't see."
Something was happening on the ridge far below. Men had pushed something big, it looked like a wagon, to the brow of the ridge. They shoved, and it went over, tumbling down the ridge, rolling down until it came to rest 100 yards from the repaired bridge. It sat, did nothing for 30 seconds, and exploded. A huge cloud burst from it and was carried downwind toward the bridge, across it, through the traffic jam at the bridgehead. And everywhere along the ridge, objects came lobbing over, falling slowly. Men pushed heavy framework forward, boxes with long arms that spewed tiny black dots in an arcing trajectory.
"Catapults!" Harvey yelled.
They were. He didn't know what powered them. Nylon cords, probably. Carthaginian women donated their hair, maybe. The catapults didn't have much range, but they didn't need it. They threw jars that burst into yellow fog on impact. The wind carried the fog down through the valley, across the advancing enemy. The new brotherhood screamed in panic. They threw away weapons, ran in pain, tearing at their clothes, threw themselves into the river to be carried away by the rushing water. They fought to get across the bridge, and from the ridges rifles fired again and again, cutting the running men down as they fled. The catapults poured a continuous rain of bursting jars, renewing the deadly yellow fog. Harvey's voice broke as he screamed into the microphone.
"They're running! They're dying! Good Lord, there must be 500 of them down out there!"
"What is happening to those who didn't cross the river?"
The voice was Alice Cox, but the question had to be Al Hardy.
"They're loading up the trucks."
"What about their weapons? Are they getting those out?"
Harvey scanned with the binoculars.
"Yes, they hadn't brought all the mortars across. There goes one of their trucks."
Harvey shuddered. The pickup, with a load of men, gasping in horror, drove down the road at high speed and didn't slow when it reached the bridge. It flung a dozen off the bridge into the water and kept going, leaving behind those it had run down in its flight.
"There were two of their machine guns on that truck," Harvey reported. "Looks like they got away."
The gas didn't cover the entire valley, and some of the new brotherhood were able to escape. Many ran screaming without weapons, but Harvey saw others pause, look for a route, and leave carrying heavy weapons. Two of the mortars were carried away before the catapults closed off that escape route. Harvey grimly reported clear areas and watched as minutes later the gas canisters dropped into them.
"Something's happening upstream," Harvey shouted. "I can't see."
"Don't worry about it. Is the road down from the reservation clear of gas?"
Alice demanded.
"Hold on a second." "Yes."
"Stand by."
Moments later, trucks came down that road. They carried Tallman's Indian troops and more ranchers. Harvey thought he recognized George Christopher in one of the trucks. They roared on in pursuit of the fleeing enemy, but were stopped at the top of the ridge beyond the road junction. Now it was the stronghold's turn to deploy and probe, search for weak spots, clear the roads. While behind them the valley had become an alien world. Its unusual atmosphere was yellow-tinged, deadly to men without pressure suits. Its native life was eerie to look upon, slow-moving quadrupeds and belly crawlers, some armed with metallic stings, growing ever more torpid until most seemed to hibernate, and only a few still moved. Like snails, they crawled on their bellies, leaving trails of red slime, and they moved at snail's pace downhill toward the river. River life thrashed about, incredibly active, then suddenly stopped moving, to float motionless with clumsy, blunt fins wavering in the current. When dark came, the silence was that of a dead, deserted world. Aftermath. From the Far East, I send you one single thought, one sole idea, written in red on every beachhead from Australia to Tokyo. There is no substitute for victory.
General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. It was too dark to see. A cold wind blew down from the Sierra. Harvey turned to Marie. Victory.
Yes, we did it. My God, Harvey, we're safe.
It was too dark to see her face, but Harvey knew she must be grinning like an idiot. He started the travel-all. Alice had told him to stay out of the valley, away from the main road. They'd have to drive to the stronghold on the dirt cowpath. He put the car in gear and moved gingerly ahead. The headlamps showed the road ahead, smooth, untraveled, but the drop to the left was steep, and Harvey knew they were sinking deep into the mud surface. It would be easy to go over the ridge. That was frightening, that they could be killed after the battle was over. But it was only a bad road, and he'd been on a lot of those. It wasn't malevolent. A wave of exhilaration swept over him. He had to fight an urge to gun the car. He had never been so aware of being alive. They rounded the mountain and crossed the ridge leading down to Senator Jellison's house, and then he did let himself go, gunning the car forward and driving through the mud at high speed, dangerously fast, over the ruts and potholes. The travel-all leaped as if to share their joy. He drove as if running away from something. He knew that, and he knew that if he let himself think about it, about what he'd seen, he would not feel joy, but an infinite sadness. Back in the valley of battle were hundreds, all ages, men, girls, women, boys, crawling with ruined lungs, leaving trails of blood that had been visible through binoculars until the merciful dark fell across the land. The dying, who had survived the end of the world.
Harvey, you can't think about them as people.
You too.
Yes, a little. But we're alive. We've won.
The travel-all leaped upward at the top of a small hillock, all four wheels briefly leaving the ground. It was stupid driving at this speed, but Harvey didn't care.
"We fought our last battle," he shouted. "Ain't gonna study war no more."
Euphoria again. The world was a lovely place for the living. Let the dead bury the dead. Harvey Randall was alive, and the enemy was defeated.
"Hail the conquering heroes come." Wish I could remember the tune. Silly language. Hero. Hell, you're more of a hero, heroine, than I am. I'd have run like hell if you'd let me. But I couldn't. Sexism. Men can't run while women are watching. Why am I babbling? Why aren't you?
I'm not because you won't give me a chance,
Marie shouted. There was laughter in her voice.
And you didn't run, and neither did I, and it would have been so easy.
She laughed again, this time with a peculiar note in it.
And now, my friend, we go collect the traditional reward for heroes. Find Maureen. You've earned it.
Strange to say I thought of that, but of course George will be coming back.
You leave George to me, Marie said primly. After all, I've got a reward coming too. You leave George to me.
I think I'm jealous of him.
Too bad.
The mood lasted only until they reached the Senator's stone ranch house and went inside. There were many others there, Al Hardy, drunk but not with liquor, grinning like a fool while others pounded him on the back. Dan Forrester, exhausted, introspective and unhappy, and no one caring. They praised him and thanked him and let him have his mood, to enjoy or hate, be glad or sad. Magicians may do as they please. Many were absent. They might be among the dead, they might have joined the pursuit. They might have fled and be fleeing still, unaware that nobody was hunting them. The victors were too tired to think about them. Harvey searched until he found Maureen, and he went to her. There was no lust between them, only an infinite tenderness, concern. They touched each other like children. There was no party, no celebration. Within minutes the gathering was finished. Some dropped into chairs and slept. Some went to their own houses. Harvey felt nothing now, only the need to rest, to sleep, to forget everything that had happened that day. He had seen this before, in men returned from patrol in Vietnam, but he had not felt it himself. Drained of energy, drained of emotion, not unhappy,
able to rouse himself to brief moments of excitement, only to have them slip away and leave him more exhausted than ever. He woke remembering that they'd won. The details were gone. There had been dreams, vivid and mixed with memories of the past few days, and as the dreams faded, so did the memories, leaving him only the word, victory. He was lying on the floor of the front room, on a rug and covered with a blanket. He had no idea how he had come there. Perhaps he had been talking with Maureen and simply fallen to the floor. Anything was possible. There were sounds in the house, people moving, smells of cooking food. He savored them all, the sounds and smells and sensations of life. The gray clouds outside the window seemed infinitely detailed, vivid and brilliant as sunlight. The bronze trophies on the walls were a marvel that needed investigation. He treasured each moment of life and what it might bring. Gradually, the mood faded. It left him desperately hungry. He got up and saw that the living room rug itself looked like a battlefield. They lay where fatigue had dropped them. Someone had lasted long enough to spread blankets and had run short. Harvey spread his own blanket over Steve Cox, who was coiled into a ball against the cold, and followed his nose toward breakfast. There was bright sunlight in the room. Maureen Jellison stared in disbelief. She was afraid to get out of bed. The bright sun might be a dream, and it was a dream she wanted to savor. Finally, she convinced herself that she was awake. It was no illusion. The sun came in the window, warm and yellow and bright. It was over an hour high. She could feel its warmth on her arms when she threw back the covers. Gradually, she came to full wakefulness. Terror and blood and a fatigue like death itself. The memories of yesterday ran together like a too-fast movie film. There had been the horror of the morning, when the Stronghold forces had to hold fast, retreating slowly, letting the Brotherhood into the valley, but never on the ridges. The gradual retreat that could not seem too obvious, with troops who couldn't be told the battle plan for fear that they would be captured. Finally, the general panic, when they had all run. "When you run, they bunch up and follow," Al Hardy had said. "Randall's reports make that pretty clear. Their commander goes by the book. So will we, up to a point." The problem had been to hold along the high ground, so that the Brotherhood would stay down in the valley, to give way along the valley floor until enough of the Brotherhood had crossed the bridge. How could they get the ranchers to fight and not run until the signal? Hardy had chosen the simplest solution to that. "If you're out there," he'd said, "if you stand, some of them will stay with you. They're men." She had resented that, but it had been no time to give Al Hardy a lecture, and he'd been right. All she'd had to do was hold on to her own courage. For someone who wasn't sure she wanted to live, that had seemed a simple job. It wasn't until she was actually under fire that she began to have doubts. Something unseen had ripped Roy Miller's side. He tried to block the wound with his forearm. His forearm nestled neatly in the great gap of torn ribs. Maureen's breakfast rose in her throat, and in his last moment Roy looked around and caught her expression. A mortar shell had exploded behind Deke Wilson and two of his men. The others rolled over and over and lay sprawled in positions that would have been hideously uncomfortable if they hadn't been dead. But Deke flew forward and upward, his arms flapping frantically, and fluttered downhill like a fledgling just learning to fly, down into the yellow murk. Joanna McPherson turned to yell at Maureen. A bullet whispered through her hair, through the spaces where her skull had been only a moment before, and Joanna's message became frantically obscene. A fragment of metal from a mortar blast shattered Jack Turner's mustard bomb as he was winding up for the throw. His friends ran from him, and his sister-in-law ran too, and Jack Turner staggered and thrashed within the yellow cloud, drowning. Pudgy Galadriel from the Shire swung her sling round and round, stepped forward, and sent a bottle of nerve gas flying far down the hill. A moment too long on the follow-through, and Galadriel stood poised like winged victory, with her head gone. Maureen saw black spots before her eyes. She leaned against a boulder and managed to stay upright. It was one thing to stand on a cliff top and contemplate, at her leisure, jumping off,
But would she have had the nerve, or was it all an act? Now she'd never know.
It was quite another to watch poor, homely Galadriel crumple with the stump of her neck spitting blood, and then, without looking to see if anyone was actually watching her, to pick up her sling and a bottle of nerve gas and swing the deadly, evil thing round and round her head, and remembering at the last second that the damn thing would fly at a tangent and not in the direction the sling was pointing when she let go, sling it down into the cannibal horde that was still coming up at them. Suddenly, Maureen Jellison had found quite a lot to live for. The gray skies, cold winds, brief snow flurries, the prospect of hunger in winter, all of that faded away. First, there was a simple realization. If you could feel terror, you wanted to live. Strange that she'd never understood that before. She dressed quickly and went outside. The bright sun was gone. She could not see the sun at all, but the sky overhead was bright and the clouds seemed much thinner than usual. Had the sunlight been a final dream? It didn't matter. The air was warm, and there was no rain. The small creek below the house was very high, and the water gurgled happily. It would be cold water, just right for trout. Birds dipped low into the stream and cried loudly. She walked down the drive to the highway. There was no traffic. There had been earlier, when the stronghold's wounded had been taken to the former county convalescent home that served as the valley's hospital. And later there would be more, when the less critically injured were brought in horse-drawn wagons. But for now the road was clear. She walked steadily on, aware of every sight and sound. The ring of an axe in the hills above. The flash of red as a red-winged blackbird darted into the brush nearby. The shouts of children herding the stronghold's pigs through the woods. The children had adjusted quickly to the new conditions. One elderly adult as teacher, a dozen or more children, two working dogs and a herd of swine. School and work. A different sort of school, with different lessons. Reading and arithmetic, certainly, but also other knowledge. To lead the pigs to dog droppings. The dogs in turn ate part of the human sewage. And always to carry a bucket to collect the pig manure, which must be brought back at night. Other lessons, how to trap rats and squirrels. Rats were important to the new ecology. They had to be kept out of the stronghold's barns. Cats did most of that. But the rats were themselves useful. They found their own food. They could be eaten. Their fur made clothing and shoes, and their small bones made needles. There were prizes for the children who caught the most rats. Closer to town was the sewage works, where the animal and human wastes were shoveled into boilers with wood chips and sawdust. The heat of fermentation sterilized everything, and the hot gases were let out through pipes that ran under City Hall and the hospital to form part of the heating system, then condensed. The resulting methanol, wood alcohol, ran the trucks that collected the wastes, with some left over for other work. The system wasn't complete. They needed more boilers and more pipes and condensers, and the work absorbed too much skilled labor. But Hardy could be deservedly proud of the start they had made. By spring, they'd have a lot of high nitrogen fertilizer from the residue in the boilers, all sterilized and ready for the crops they'd plant, and there should be enough methanol to run tractors for the initial heavy work of plowing. "We've done well," she thought. "There's a lot more to do, all kinds of work. Windmills to build, water wheels, crops to plant, a forge to set up." Hardy had found an old book on working bronze and methods of casting it in sand, but they hadn't had time to do much about it yet. Now they'd have the time, now that there was no real threat of war hanging over them. Harvey Randall had been singing when he came into the ranch house after the battle. "Ain't gonna study war no more." It wasn't going to be easy. She looked up at the clouds. They were turning dark. She wished the sunlight would break through, not because she wanted to see the sun again, although she certainly did, but because it would be so appropriate, a symbol of their eventual success. Instead, there were only the darkening clouds. But she refused to let them depress her. It would be so easy to fall back into her black mood of despair. Harvey Randall had been right about that. It was worth almost anything to spare people that feeling of helplessness and doom.
But first you had to conquer it in yourself. You had to look squarely at this new and terrible world, know what it could and would do to you, and shout defiance. Then you could get to work. The thought of Harvey reminded her of Johnny Baker, and she wondered what had happened to the expedition to the power plant. They should be all right now. With the new Brotherhood defeated, the power plant should be all right, now that they'd repelled that first tentative attack. But their last message had come 3 days ago. Maybe there had been a second attack. Certainly the radio was out. Maureen shivered. Maybe a damn transistor had given up the ghost, or maybe everybody was dead. There was just no way to tell. Johnny would have been in the thick of things. He was too damn visible. So let it be a transistor, she told herself, and keep busy. She turned downhill toward the hospital. Alim Nassour gasped for breath and couldn't find it. He sat propped up in the truck bed. If he lay down, he would drown. His lungs were filling anyway, and it wouldn't be long. They had failed. The Brotherhood was defeated, and Alim Nassour was a dead man. Swan was dead. Jackie was dead. Most of his band dead in the valley of the Tule River, killed by choking clouds of yellow gas that stung like fire. He felt Erica's hands moving a cloth over his face, but he couldn't focus his eyes on her. She was a good woman. White woman, but she stayed with Alim, got him out when the others ran away. He wanted to tell her so, if he could speak. He felt the truck slow and heard someone call a challenge. They had reached the new camp, and somebody had organized sentries. Hooker? Alim thought the hook had lived. He hadn't crossed the river. He was directing the mortars, and that should have been safe, unless he was caught by the pursuit. Alim wondered if he wanted Hooker to have lived. Nothing really mattered anymore. The hammer had killed Alim Nassour. The truck stopped near a campfire, and he felt himself being lifted out. They put him near the fire, and that felt good. Erica stayed by him, and someone brought him a cup of hot soup. It was too much trouble to tell them they were wasting good broth, that he wouldn't live past the next time he fell asleep. He'd drown in his own phlegm. He coughed hard to try to clear his lungs so he could talk, but that hurt too bad, and he stopped. Gradually he heard a voice. "And ye have defied the Lord God of hosts. Ye placed your faith in armies, ye angels of the Lord. Strategy! What do the angels need of strategy? Place your trust in the Lord God Jehovah. Do his work. Work his will, O my people. Destroy the citadel of Satan as God wills it, and then can ye conquer." The voice of the prophet lashed over him. "Weep not for the fallen, for they have fallen in the service of the Lord. Great shall be their reward. O ye angels and archangels, hear me. This is no time for sorrow. This is a time to go forth in the name of the Lord." "No," Alim gasped, but no one heard. "We can do it," a voice said nearby. It took Alim a moment to recognize it. Jerry Owen. "They don't have any poison gas in the power plant. Even if they do, it won't matter. We take all the mortars and recoilless rifles out on the barge and blow up the turbines. That'll end that power plant."
"Strike in the name of God,"
Armitage was shouting. There were some answers now.
"Hallelujah,"
someone called.
"Amen,"
another said. Tentative at first, but as Armitage continued, the responses became more enthusiastic.
"Shit!"
That had to be Sergeant Hooker. Alim couldn't turn his head to look at him.
"Alim, you hear me?"
Alim nodded slightly.
"He says he hears," Erica said. "Leave him alone. He's got a rest. I wish he'd get some sleep."
Sleep. That would kill him for sure. Every breath was a fight, something to struggle for, an effort of will. If he relaxed for a moment, he'd stop breathing.
"What the hell do I do now?"
Hooker was asking.
"You the only brother left I can rap with."
Words formed on Alim's lips. Erica translated.
"He asks how many brothers are left."
"10,
Hooker said.
10 blacks. Were they the last blacks in the world? Of course not. Africa was still there, wasn't it? They hadn't seen any black faces among their enemies, though. Maybe there weren't any more in California. He whispered again.
He says 10 is not enough,
Erica said.
Yeah.
Hooker bent low to speak into Aline's ear. No one else could hear.
I gotta stay with this preacher, he said. Aline, is he crazy? Is he right? I can't think no more.
Aline shook his head. He didn't want to talk about that. Armitage was speaking again of the paradise that waited for the fallen. The words blended into the vague, slow thoughts that crept into Aline's consciousness. Paradise. Maybe it was true. Maybe that crazy preacher was right. It was better to think so.
He knows the truth,
Aline gasped. The fire's warmth was almost pleasant. Darkness gathered in his head despite the glimpses of morning sunshine he thought he'd seen earlier. The preacher's words sank through the dark.
Strike now, ye angels, this very day, this very hour. It is the will of God.
The last thing Aline heard was Sergeant Hooker shouting,
Amen!
When Maureen reached the hospital, Leonila Malik took her and led her firmly into a front room.
I came to help, Maureen said, but I wanted to talk to the wounded. One of the Talifson boys was in my group, and he...
He's dead, Leonila said. There was no emotion in her voice.
I could use some help. Did you ever use a microscope?
Not since college biology class.
You don't forget how,
Leonila said.
First, I want a blood sample. Please, sit down here.
She took a hypodermic needle from a pressure cooker.
My autoclave, she said. Not very pretty, but it works.
Maureen had wondered what had happened to the pressure cookers from the ranch house. She winced as the needle went into her arm. It was dull. Leonila drew out the blood sample and carefully squirted it into a test tube that had come from a child's chemistry set. The tube went into a sock. A piece of parachute cord was attached to the sock, and Leonila used that to whirl the test tube around and around her head.
Centrifuging, she said. I show you how to do this, and then you can do some of the work. We need more help in the lab.
She continued to swing the test tube.
There, she said. We have separated the cells from the fluid. Now we draw off the fluid, so, and wash the cells with saline.
She worked rapidly.
Here on the shelf we have cells and fluid from patients who need blood. I will test yours against theirs.
Don't you want to know my blood type? Maureen asked.
Yes, in a moment, but I must make the test anyway. I do not know the patient's blood types, and I have no way to find out. And this is more certain. It is merely very inconvenient.
The room had been an office. The walls had been painted not long ago and were well scrubbed. The office table where Leonila worked was formica and very clean.
Now, Leonila said, I put samples of your cells into a sample of the patient's serum, and the patient's cells in yours. So, and we look in the microscope.
The microscope had also come from a child's collection. Someone had burned the local high school before Hardy had thought to send an expedition for its science equipment.
This is very difficult to work with, Leonila said. But it will work. You must be very careful with the focus.
She peered into the microscope.
Ah, Rulo cells. You cannot be a donor for this patient. Look so that you will know.
Maureen looked into the microscope. At first she saw nothing, but she worked the focus, the feel of it coming back to her fingers. Leonila was right, she thought. You don't really forget how. She remembered that you weren't supposed to close the other eye, but she did anyway. When the instrument was properly focused, she saw blood cells.
You mean the little stacks like poker chips? She asked. Poker chips? Like saucers. Yes, those are Rulo formations. They indicate clumping. Now, what was your blood type?
A, Maureen said.
Good, I will mark that down.
We must use these file cards, one for every person. I note on your card that your blood clumps that of Jacob Vinge, and note